Hi there, and welcome to the Skylight Books author reading series. If you'd like to learn more about us and our many upcoming author events, please visit skylightbooks.com, where you can browse our inventory, buy books, and join our Friends with Benefits Club. You can also follow us on Twitter, Tumblr, and Facebook. To speak to a real live bookseller like me, please call 323-660-1175. Thanks for your support, and enjoy.
So, in the spirit of a very male event that happened over the weekend, I need to borrow from it. Let's get ready to book launch! Weighing in at 275 pages. From Rowena, where the air conditioning went out and all the electricity. She's already a bestseller here at Skylight Books. It is the hottest day of the year. Please welcome author and soon-to-be bestseller of her second book, Karina Chicano. Are we all the ones who have a little bit of anger that is like through our system?
Yeah.
You castrated anyone yet, Mom?
But I cried a lot.
You cried a lot, right? I did. I got really upset reading the book. And who else is? Has it been emotional? Those who've no.
No.
What are feelings you had in reading it? What's that? You laughed a lot. So yeah, I mean, it's. I feel like it's a. It's congratulations. It's like it's so. The writing I find so rich. I feel like it's a combo of autobiography, of film criticism, of everything fucked up about patriarchy. All of like film history. It's a lot of amazing stuff in 275 pages, yeah. So congratulations. So you play the girl. Talk about where this title comes from and what got you writing this book.
Okay, so the title actually is taken directly from a quote. I came across this interview that Isla Fisher gave in an Australian paper, and it was like a few years after she did The Wedding Crashers, and she was asked if she'd had a ton of roles offered her after that, and she said that she hadn't, and at first she thought it was her, you know, something wrong with her, and but instead she realized that in Hollywood all the roles were written for men and you play the girl. And it just really resonated with me, and then what was really interesting is that almost immediately it was picked up all over the internet and mocked, like within 2 days.
Who was mocking it?
Everybody. Like every headline was sort of like, there was one that was like, Borat's babe, plans sex revolution based on that quote. Yeah. And I know it really bummed me out.
Yeah. Well, it's so does everyone have a name tag? Has everyone picked a role that they're playing? Train wreck. Karina is psycho and mommy. So these are all sort of archetypes. Psycho mommy. These are all. Are there the train wrecks in the house? Psychos. Are you here? Princesses. Roll call for princesses. Fembots. Manic pixie dream girl. Stepford wives. Let's see who are Stepford wives. Serving us. So there's a lot of revisiting of a lot of movies that I remember watching as a kid,
yeah.
And some I haven't seen. But can you talk about the process of you watch a lot of movies or
so
what?
This started like a lot of people here know. I was a film critic and a TV critic, and I for a few years I was sort of like in a dark room. It felt like 24 hours a day, like in the Parallax View. I don't know if you guys know the movie The Parallax View. Everybody's like holding his eyes open and like, you know, flashing these horrible images at him. And it felt like, after a while, it really felt overwhelming to me. And so I think I just started to find, to like look for ways to figure out why I felt so bad. And so it was sort of a process of like, kind of going back and excavating the things that I'd seen when I was young and looking for the things where there was some tension, like I loved them, but I also felt under about it and I didn't really know why. And so I kind of would go back and like maybe watch it again and read about it and then also just sort of read about what was happening at the time.
Is this true? I feel like you tracing your history, everything from your childhood to you deciding, can I be a mom or not, against what you're seeing in the movies that
Sort of like this process of like looking for myself in the things that I was watching and sort of going back and trying to find some path and, you know, having a hard time doing that. And in fact, like I could read from the beginning.
That plays it out.
That sort of talks about that time, like when this was sort of inspired by kind of being immersed in all of this.
So for those of you who bought your copies or about to buy your copies, we're reading from X.
From the intro,
yeah.
So this is about the kind of like when I was a critic. When I first started to work as a TV critic in 2000, it was probably the best time to be writing about TV. And when I first started to work as a movie critic in 2004, it was probably the worst time to be writing about movies. I found myself spending hours in the dark consuming toxic doses of superhero movies, wedding-themed romantic comedies, crypto-fascist pants to war, and romances about unattractive, immature young men and the gorgeous women desperate to marry them. Hardly any movies had female protagonists. Most actresses were cast to play the girl. The girl was the adult version of the princess. As a kid, I believed the princess was the protagonist because she'd seemed the most central to the story. The word protagonist comes from the Greek for the leading actor in a contest or cause, and a protagonist is a person who wants something and does something to get it. The girl doesn't act though, she behaves. She has no cause but a play. She doesn't want anything, she is wanted. She isn't a winner, she's won. She doesn't self-actualize but aids the hero in self-actualization. Sometimes I'd sit in the theater and feel mounting despair and think, why do you keep telling me this? Why are you talking to me this way? Of course there were good movies that reconnected me to myself and the world, but most of the time I felt like some half-mad ethnographer, lost in another dimension, frantically gathering field notes from inside this dark mirror in which I couldn't for the life of me locate myself. I began to feel unreal, peripheral in my own life, trapped in a dream not my own. I felt like a canary in a coal mine, bearing traumatized witness to the inhumanity of the tent pole threequel, chirping my tiny impotent protests into the dark void. I felt, I guess, like Alice in Wonderland. It helped to take notes for some reason. I wrote things down to, I don't know how to pronounce this word. I realized I forgot to check. To assuage the bricked in, thank you Annabelle, thank you for the bricked in, bloodied fingernail feeling of despair that sometimes came over me, to assert my existence, to remind myself to buy bananas on the way home. I filled notebook after notebook with loopy, illegible scrawls of outrage. I know everybody says their handwriting is loopy and illegible, but mine really was because I wrote in the dark.
Wow. So, yeah, one thing, So you talk a lot about how the princess is not really a protagonist, the idea of a princess, and can you talk more about examples from movies that illustrate that?
Well, I guess like one of the things is that when movies for little girls and mostly like Disney movies always have a princess as a protagonist, almost always, and the exception, there are two exceptions. And so we're sort of used to seeing that character as the female lead character, and even in movies that aren't specifically about princesses, it's kind of a princess role. But when you look at it, the princess isn't really the character who's like out trying to right some wrong or to like achieve something or get something that they want. She's always like the object of the story. And so it's just sort of that like way, it's like that the frame is sort of moved over and tricked you into thinking she's at the center of the story, but she's really not. Like the prince is still the center of the story, the camera just moved over, you know?
The prince is the center of the story because he's the one who provides some sort of liberation or validation.
He's the one that does something, you know, and like, rescues her, or whatever it is that he does, kills the dragon and Sleeping Beauty and kills Maleficent. You know, there's just no, the princess, especially in a lot of the Disney movies, is unconscious a lot of the time.
So I thought it was really interesting because you brought back 2007. Mm-hmm. Back, things are like so surreal right now that I'm like, man, let's just go back to those bald Britney days, mm-hmm. like when things were just getting a little wacky.
Yeah.
Connect that. You really describe in this interesting way about the princesses and the sort of like these figures that we publicly torture, or, mm-hmm. or we love to look at them, but we also love to torture them, uh-huh. and literally prod them with cameras. So
yeah.
Can you talk about...
Yeah, I mean, I really became obsessed with... I was working at the LA Times, and so I was in a newsroom, and for some reason in 2007, like, there was a camera, or there was a TV in the newsroom, in the calendar session that was, like, turned on TMZ all day long. Yeah. And I remember it used to just, like, I mean... drive me insane. Like, I used to get really jittery and weirded out by like having to like sort of watch this gossip all the time. And one of the main things that was happening was that Britney and all her cohort, Lindsay Lohan and I guess Paris Hilton to a lesser degree, were being hunted by the paparazzi, and
they're also running around with no underwear on.
They were, but it was sort of like, you know, it, like every moment they were being captured in these strange situations. And actually, you know, it's true, but it really tells you something about how stories are framed, right? Because like I later saw a YouTube video of Britney pulling up to a gas station and being completely surrounded by paparazzi, and like so many blinding flashes in her face that she couldn't see, and she was like literally stumbling around because she couldn't see where she was going, and they would be like they'd be like, you know, heckling her and like saying horrible things to her. And so there's no way that at one point the camera wasn't going to capture some, like, you know, tragic image of her either stumbling or looking terrible. And so, you know, it really, like, when I saw those videos, I was like, wow, like, that doesn't, the narrative that you get from the tabloids really doesn't show you what's going into this picture, into getting this picture, you know?
The narrative we're getting is just this, she's a train wreck.
Right, the narrative, and it was like this punishing thing, like, the spectacle of the train wreck was so intense at the time, and we were so obsessed with it, and it's like, there was a war. Mm-hmm. And like all anyone cared about was Britney's underwear. There was even like a figurine, like someone's, I think there was a bobblehead of like no underwear Britney, but this is the C-section scar that you can see.
Oh wow.
Yeah. So like it was such a distraction, and I was reading about it, and I read this thing that was really interesting that talked about how it kind of, the whole Britney persecution thing might have started with when Michael Moore did Fahrenheit 9/11. There's a cut, there's a direct cut, oops, sorry, from
that's right.
Something about
it was her being
the war, and then they interview her, and they say, what do you think? And she says, and, you know, well, I think we shouldn't second guess the president. And then it shows, I think it was like the Twin Towers coming down. It's like literally blaming Britney for the whole thing, you know, the Iraq War. So it was kind of like at that point, she just starts to get, just to be hounded like this animal. And it was like, I don't know, for some reason it was hard for me to watch.
Mm-hmm. It was, I remember just being like, just so exhausting, mm-hmm. watching. Yet I would take that back. Mm-hmm. The moment over what's happening this year,
yeah.
But because that's what the bottom looks like.
Yeah.
So why there is sort of this modern day dichotomy, like you've heard of like the virgin whore complex, and what are you seeing? You sort of describe it in modern versions. Like what is. Especially like the sex bot.
Oh, uh-huh. Well, stuff, and she was an example of it, and I think that's there's something in that dichotomy that like makes people hate girls like Britney. It's like she was the child star and the mouseketeer or whatever, and then she like grows up and is like hypersexualized, and then everyone's just like descends on her with like savage, you know, hatred. And I think that there's this weird expectation of like, it's the new version of the modern version of it, I think, is a kind of super hot but like purity pledge that, you know, where it was at the time, like, I'm a virgin, but
like how Christina Aguilera,
yeah, but I'm making
both,
this video
both bad,
yeah, and it's very confusing. It's like the constant mixed message and like the weird, you know, extreme like irreconcilable extremes of these things that you can never get it right. You know, there's like, it's impossible to sort of find the right way to be.
This is a curveball question that does not explain your book. Explain Kim Kardashian to me. How does that factor in? Like, she's on a sex tape, she doesn't do anything, she's, where does she fit in this paradigm of
She's interesting. I haven't really thought that much about her, actually. For some reason, I've somehow, like, squirted around her. But she, I think that it's really interesting that she's got this kind of, she basically distilled this, like, just performed femininity and just performed it, and that's it. Like, that's all she's got, you know? Mm-hmm. She's just got, like, eyelashes. Sure. That's, like, a lot of money for eyelashes.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. It's just, like, she just is that image and puts it out, and, you know, it was lucrative. I think that I think that we've gone back to this thing where, like, appearing for women has, you know, strangely really moved backwards. Or I don't know if backwards, but it's certainly gone away from what it was when I was young. I mean, part of what made me want to write the book was that I was little in the 70s, and there was the media, especially for kids, was really influenced by the feminist movement, and it was pretty progressive, and it was not very gender divided. And
you talk about some of those shows.
Yeah, like, well, both shows for kids, like just Sesame Street and Zoom and, I don't know, Electric Company, like all the stuff that we just, like, grew up watching. And then also the grown-up stuff that I liked, like Laverne and Shirley or Mary Tyler Moore. It just wasn't, you know, the people looked kind of like anyone. They weren't, everyone wasn't, like, super styled. They're, like, fashion and entertainment hadn't completely melded yet, so every actor wasn't a brand ambassador all the time.
Yeah.
So people just looked like people.
Yeah.
And that really changed after, you know.
What are those pivotal shifts that you see in the way women have been portrayed on screen since you were a kid in the 70s?
Well, I think, like, you know, in the 70s there was a sort of for one thing, there were many more, it felt to me, like, stories of just women, like, living lives and doing stuff, you know, or, like, you could watch Laverne and Shirley and it was just, like, two funny friends.
With normal butts.
Yeah. Right. Normal clothes and, like, crappy apartment. And then in the 70s there were all these sort of, like, liberation through divorce movies that were sort of like a really different story trajectory. Like, instead of working toward the marriage plot, it was kind of like what happens after and sort of leaving that.
What are some of those?
Well, An Unmarried Woman is like the seminal one, but there's, like, you know, like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore and all those movies where people just sort of, like, what happens after. You know, there were, and then, like, in the 80s, there were also, like, sort of, you started to see sort of teen girl characters for the first time, but they were sort of a little more realistic, you know, and you had, like, John Hughes characters and stuff. And then, but for me, then you started to get sort of, like, 80s kickasses that started to, like, be, you know, this kind of Reaganite ideological, you know, fantasies of,
so,
like.
Are you talking about, like, Wonder Woman, or?
Like, in those days, more like.
Working Girl. Oh.
Yeah, or like more like all the movies with how are you stumped?
You know.
With Demi Moore, like, you know,
yeah.
You know, like, and suddenly they felt like they started to, like, depart from any kind of recognizable reality and go into this, like, 80s.
So it's Reagan's fault.
It is Reagan's fault. It's like America, fuck yeah, kind of, you know, this sort of, like, symbol of. So, and then Pretty Woman happened, and then that's it, you know.
And you think that Pretty Woman is the.
Absolutely.
So, like, if you can want to talk about that movie, it
well,
it's. It's a movie that you describe. Am I getting this right? There's a bunch of movies you describe. Is that the one that when your friends played it, you went to the corner to sulk?
Oh, yeah. There was a Thanksgiving where, like, some grown-ups were watching it and loving it, and I was just like, please, blame it. I think I saw it because Gary Marshall's kids went to college with me, and so, and one of them, his friend Lennon, had a cameo, and so they're like, oh, let's go watch it.
It's so LA.
Yeah. Well, it was in Chicago, but. But I remember thinking, like, God, that movie is such a throwback. Like, who's gonna love that movie? Nobody's gonna like that movie. Like, and I was just like, that is hilariously, you know, irrelevant or just strange movie. Like, what a throwback. And it really took me by surprise that people loved it, you know.
And it's a weird redux of the, I think you just played about the princess there.
Yeah,
except it's, like, it's a prostitute who gets rescued by Richard Gere.
Yeah, it's Cinderella as a prostitute, which I just couldn't reconcile. I just couldn't do it. My brain would not let me do it. Yeah.
And so you think that that's maybe that movie created a shift, that plus Reagan.
Well, I don't know if that movie created the shift, but that was the moment where I think like you know, there's another interesting movie that I read about, this sort of people making a juxtaposition between Saturday Night Fever and Flashdance, and how in some ways they're similar, but Saturday Night Fever is about, you know, is still rooted in this guy's real life. And then he goes dancing, and then he has, like, he's able to sort of escape his life, but then he's back in real life. And Flashdance is just a music video, and nothing about it is real. In fact, it's just, like, aggressively denies reality from start to finish in every conceivable way.
And talk about the plot, because I didn't remember the plot until I read story. I didn't realize she was lyrics. She's a steel town girl on a Saturday night, but for some reason I just remember a girl dancing in a factory.
No, she's dancing in a strip club that's not really a strip club. So she's an arc welder by day.
And a ballet dancer, right?
She aspires to be a ballet dancer, but somehow she's like a union welder. She's like old enough to be a union welder, but she doesn't realize she's too old to start ballet because she's like 19. No one tells her that. So she's like trying to like try out for the ballet academy while arc welding. She goes to work at the factory, like no one sexually harasses her. She looks like Jennifer Beals. She's Jennifer Beals. She's the only woman of color. She's 19. No one says boo. Nothing happens. And then at night, she like performs at this club.
And for the workers.
It's like a blue collar bar that where some women dance. They don't take off their clothes, and everyone is very appreciative of their performance rights.
Those places would not stay in business now. They would need grants to stay in business.
You never see her filling out a grant application. And meanwhile, but she's like, she does has these like elaborate costumes and lighting. It's like this huge production. It's like how she does it without the NBA, I don't know. And then she, you know,
she her boss, her job, right? She has a relationship.
And her boss, and then she, her boss falls in love with her. He owns.
Who's like twice his, her age?
Yes, twice. Yeah. He's 40, she's anyway, but that, like, everything about the film is really, it's just fascinating, and like, but I loved it as a kid because it was, it would be so amazing if, like, life could really be like that, you know? So, like, I think that as a kid I was like, oh yeah, like, I'm gonna do that, like, I'm gonna be an artist, I'm gonna have, like, some day job and be an artist and live in a huge loft, and no one's ever gonna mess with me. I'm never gonna be scared or worried about money. It's gonna be great. The idea, like, girls never got to see that. I think that romantic image of the Byronic hero, and that was very attractive.
She's also in a very male world.
Yeah.
Which is a different way of seeing women, right?
Yeah.
Seeing them handling welding equipment and
everything. Like, she's
a union member at 19.
Yeah, her name is Alex. Like, you know, she has a boy's name. She has a pit bull. She lives in a warehouse. Like, it was very attractive. Like, you just didn't really see anything like that. You know, as crazy as it was, like, I was 14 or something, and I just thought it was amazing.
Yeah, and there's you quote Alice in Wonderland a lot. That seems to be really pivotal.
Yeah.
Lewis Carroll quotes all over this book.
Well, it's sort of organized around that.
They were organized. And can you talk about what your affinity was?
I think that for me, I tell a story that I tried to, I bought the book for Kira and I tried to read it to her, my daughter Kira.
And she
wasn't very interested in it, and I realized that I hadn't been very interested in it when I was little.
Why weren't you into it? It's weird, right?
It's weird.
It's really weird.
It's really weird, and I think that, like, you're not used to that weird girl, and so she wanted to read Sleeping Beauty instead, which is what we read every single night. And I remember being sort of like, as an adult, kind of bothered by it. But then when I would think about when I was her age, I was like, I felt exactly the same way. You know, I thought that Alice was rude and overly emotional and annoying and pushy, bossy. You know, all the bad girl things. And Sleeping Beauty was my favorite princess too. So she didn't want to read it, and when I went back and I read it on my own, I realized I was really identifying with it. I felt that my experience, like, growing up in pop culture, and especially spending, like, sort of a concentrated number of years watching so much, and, like, paying so much attention to movies and TV, was, like, going down this rabbit hole.
Mm. Is there a, I don't know, I had a question about that, but I forgot it, so.
Well, I can read too. Like, I was going to read another thing it's from the Playboy Bunnies chapter.
Okay.
Because this is, like, one of the things that, one of the places that I start is with my, my grandfather collected Playboys, and he, you know, it wasn't like a furtive thing, it was very proud, and he... it was for the articles. He had them leather-bound by year, so they looked like encyclopedias. behind his green felted poker table. Like, he had the whole, like, James Bond book. And so, and I thought
that was buying his magazines. That's
he
weird. Your grandpa was weird.
He was a fastidious kind of a person. And he, like, he just, you know, preserved them that way by year. So it was like, you know, 1960 to 1973 or something.
And back then they had pubic hair. We don't have pubic hair anymore.
Yeah. They were very, like, it was an anthropological kind of experience. Anyway, so I, as a little kid, like, I was very interested in them, and, like, my cousin, my brother, and I would like, sneak them and hide and stuff, and so but then I just have this memory of, like, you know, how confused I was when I was stuff that I was doing. So Playboy pictorials were all culture, no nature. All those gauzy photos of naked girls alone in their kitschy rooms with their props and their yarn ribbon pigtails, like mine, had a strangely static and hermetic quality that made the girl's nakedness look somehow artificial. They made me think of the taxidermied animals at the Natural History Museum in Chicago and New York. It was like they were specimens, more lifelike than alive. That they were stripped of their clothes didn't bother me as much as that they were stripped of all context. They were isolated and frozen in time. Even the outdoor shots seemed to be taken behind glass. The girl's accompanying biographical squibs only added to this impression, resembling the plaques next to museum dioramas, detailing an extinct animal's name, geographic provenance, statistics, height, weight, bust, weight, and hip measurements, and dietary patterns and mating behaviors, or turn-ons and turn-offs. The Playboy collection was a museum of girls, a taxonomy of girls. The pictures fascinated me and filled me with ontological terror at the same time. I knew, because everybody knew, that only girls were sexy, that sexiness was girls, it was exclusively female. This confused me, so I kept going back to the magazines trying to figure it out. It made me uncomfortable in ways I couldn't begin to express. The model's aura of stuffed bunny obliviousness, by the way, was precisely the vibe that Playboy was going for. In 1967, Hugh Hefner told the Italian journalist Oriana Fallaci that he'd called the models bunnies because, quote, "The rabbit, the bunny in America, has a sexual meaning, and I chose it because it's a fresh animal. Shy, vivacious, jumping, sexy. First it smells you, then it escapes, then it comes back, and you feel like caressing it, playing with it. A girl resembles a bunny, joyful, joking. Consider the kind of girl we made popular, the playmate of the month. She is never sophisticated, a girl you cannot really have. She is young, healthy, she is a young, healthy, simple girl, the girl next door. We are not interested in the mysterious, difficult woman, the son of the child, who wears elegant underwear with lace, and she is sad, and somehow mentally filthy. The playboy girl has no lace, no underwear. She is naked, well washed with soap and water, and she is happy. I didn't read this as a kid, of course, but I still think the message got across. Playboy's idea of woman was a naked fairy tale princess, a young, dumb, defenseless, trusting, easily manipulated woodland creature. She gave herself entirely because she was too inexperienced to know any better. She was a fresh animal, well washed with soap and water. She could not learn, grow, or change. She could not really exist in a temporal sense. All she could do was try to preserve and display herself. Experience made her difficult. It got her banished to the witchy cottage in the forest. She had to remain a dumb bunny, an unconscious body, frozen in time, and preserved in amber for as long as she could in order to survive. The sexy lady is the only kind of lady that openly exists in the sunshine of the symbolic realm. She's the only kind of lady that warrants being looked at, paid attention to, or acknowledged in order to be listened to. A lady should be nice to look at. There should be no doubt as to her sexual desirability, but this will undermine her argument no matter how sophisticated. We are not interested in sadness, sophistication, or experience. We secretly believe that female subjectivity is filth."
We're not reading this, which is on the next paragraph, but I totally had Me Too moment. You described watching the Miss America, Miss World, Miss Universe pageant and actually thinking it was an actual statistical ranking of the prettiest women in the country, the world, the universe.
Yeah.
And I did too. I was like, oh, yeah. Contests, they must be accurate.
Absolutely.
But all the women...
Because it was like sports.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was like points and sports, you know, it was, what's the word? It was like a... objective reality.
And I remember watching these pageants and all the women kind of looked the same, even if they were from different countries. They all sort of looked the same, and I remember thinking, yeah, I want to grow up and be sexy. Who would like? I did fantasize about it. I'm so repressed. Chinese, you know, and I remember seeing these images and thinking, like, how do I sanitize everything, like deprogram memory, history, any kind of pain. Like I was Hugh Hefner describes as like what the difficult moment, the mysterious woman. Like, we don't want that. We just want clean, washed women. And I'm like, how? Like, literally, I'd see these magazines and I was like, I can't believe they poop out of that same butt. But you can't tell. They're so clean.
Like
melon.
Right.
Not in front of.
Share.
No, you've heard that, right? That he doesn't. He's never been anywhere near her when she's pooped. Like, he doesn't know, or I don't know anything. Like, nothing.
He has a big problem with bodies doing what bodies do. Transactional. It's financial.
I think that that's the thing, because I think that the thing is that you're trained at the same time to think that it seems weird to be that it doesn't seem like a real thing, but at the same time the alternative has to be worse, because it seems worse, it's portrayed as worse, right?
Mm-hmm. So what you fast forward to, and this is fast forwarding many chapters ahead, and a lot of this reading this book, by the way, is reading it, stopping, Googling. Is this real? So there's a guy named Dave Cat who I guess bought a real doll because he couldn't find love in the real world. And we had the lunch the other week. You were sort of describing, like,
it's gotten to the point where when women cannot be what men are conditioned to believe, and I'm paraphrasing, you can tell me what it is you said, but like when men can't get that woman they want, they literally then have to project it onto something that won't move, that they can control. And in the case of this guy, Dave Cat, he has real dolls that he has relationships with, that he's named, that live with
him. That he takes to restaurants.
That he takes to restaurants. Yeah, so that was a Google, that was our pause of reading to stop, and that guy's real.
Yeah.
But his girlfriend
is not. He's turned it into a whole, girlfriend's him. Yeah, I think that, like, for me, it was just an interesting thread to follow that the main idea, I think, of the book is that there's men and women, and then there's this idea of woman that is somehow like superimposed, and that's a very real feeling or very prevalent, and that actual women are sort of constantly measured against, and as technology has advanced, I guess, like, that has become more of a material reality.
You talk a lot about how the required, well, one, that we all, I think most women in this room know this, that we all are supposed to be dead at 40 and,
right,
if not 28 in this town. So you talk about that and the rigid standards. Can you talk more about sort of how there's a different timeline for men?
Yeah, I mean,
even in modeling was an example.
Yeah, the modeling thing was really interesting. I like that like the age for a girl modeling is something like 16, but for a man it's like 33. So it's just like the idea of how you construct like adulthood or the prime of life, like in the whole the story of like how, you know, what the story of a girl is supposed to sort of end, you know, end with this happy ending that is marriage. It's supposed to happen very young, you know, and it's the only story, it's the only adventure of your life. Like, God help you if you have any others, you know, like that's what will get you.
Psycho mom. Yeah, and then after, yeah, like the most stories end with everything gets fixed, she gets married,
right,
blah blah blah,
and then after hear from her.
Yeah, she comes back as maybe a character actor, visit like right. at the wedding, you know, right, playing the mother-in-law or something, right? Right?
So like, you kind of, they disappear into this domestic invisible space, and I mean, that's why I love the stuff for wives so much, because it's like what happens then, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that that's one of the things that's so bad is that, like, we don't grow up seeing any kind of trajectory for ourselves. Like, we are asked to, like, see adult women represented by girls, mm-hmm, almost exclusively. Like, I mean, one example in the book, I guess, from that essay you're talking about is, like, there was a Harper's Bazaar, but all the magazines have this, like, sexy at every age or whatever thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they had like the spread, you know, so it was like what to wear in your 20s. Okay, and so the model was about the age of, was in her 20s. And then what to wear in your 30s. And the model's still in her 20s, but they look the same, it doesn't matter. And then in your 40s, oh, and they had, in each one they had a real life example. So those pictures kept getting smaller until they got to the 60s, and then they had Barbara Walters like in a thumbnail and a girl in like this like boucle Chanel suit looking stupid, you know, in this like,
put a little girl and like a little senior,
like a model,
yeah,
in this like, you know, very grandmotherly suit. And it was interesting, it was like even in the thing that says how to look great at 60, they will not show
you a 60-year-old model.
They just won't. Like, she was so tiny, you know, you could sort of, it was like, there's Barbara Walters.
We're not gonna think about that. Wow.
And I think of that, like, so you never see yourself in the future. You never see a trajectory for you. And you never see adulthood. Like, you never see, like, the prime of adulthood. You never see yourself, like, doing stuff as an adult. You know, when mothers are cast, they're like a couple of years older than the adolescents that they're supposed to be mothers.
And you talk about some of these, a lot of actual, you go into who's directed, who's written the films, who produced the films, a lot of men, and but you talk about like some examples that if you actually did the math with
Oh yeah, I always do the math.
Some of the families, like if this actual...
Wait, when did she have that kid? Wait, that's illegal!
If this actress actually had this kid, she would have been 15 years old when she had the first kid.
Yeah, like that's terrible. Like you're like, I mean, one example for me was when in Trainwreck where the Brie Larson character, what is she doing in that 10,000 square foot house? Like,
I always look at that, like how many people who are younger than me on TV have big houses?
Yeah,
that's not fair.
And also like, what is she doing there? Like with this, you know, with this like 13-year-old stepson, she's like 20. You know? I don't know, so there's like, I can never not see that. I'm like, how do people not just go, whoa, what is that, you know?
Are there examples of movies that you think positive is such a tricky word, but that step outside of this framework of these, you play the girl?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are more now. And it's not even like, I don't think it's always a progression. I think we do go in circles. So it's not now and never before. I mean, like, even in the teens, in the silent film era, there were probably way better representations of women and more women making movies than now. But I think that now, especially with TV, like being so decentralized, like you see a lot of stuff that you would have never seen that's amazing.
If you could order a 600 cable channel package.
Streaming. For me, it's sort of like the fact that you can see like Orange is the New Black,
yeah.
Buffalo, or...
That, yeah. Yeah, that Orange is the New Black was not in here. I've been watching that.
I couldn't put everything in. someone in New York was like, why is Dirty Dancing not in here? And I was like, I don't know.
You do cover a lot of movies.
I tried to. Yeah.
Expanded my watch list. Do you want to read a...
Well, I don't know. Do we want to take questions?
Do you want to do Q&A?
Yeah, maybe
we take
questions.
Any other questions brewing out there? Or reactions?
Read some more.
Yeah. Read, okay. Read
another one?
Okay.
Yeah. Questions in New York? Okay. Okay, so this is from an essay called Bad Girlfriend. Once in the late 90s, I spent 3 strange days hanging around the Sheraton Hotel in Universal City, which is not so much a city as a mostly unincorporated area in Los Angeles County that houses Universal Studios and its attendant theme park. Reporting on an event that billed itself as an academic conference on the First Amendment and pornography. I was there on assignment for Salon's then new, now dead, education section. The hook was that the conference was being co-sponsored by the Center for Sex and Gender Research at California State Northridge, and something called the Free Speech Coalition, which turned out to be the lobbying arm of the adult entertainment industry.
Yeah.
Having never attended an academic conference, I didn't know what to expect. But the mix yielded some highly amusing juxtapositions, some bordering on parody. Panels on Victorian pornography and erotic vases from ancient Greece were presented alongside chats with porn stars. My job, as I remember, was to soak in the ambiance, filter it through my disbelief, and report back in arch tones. The article would write itself. No doubt my experience at the conference was filtered through a trifecta of inexperience, selective focus, and confirmation bias. That I was quickly struck by how hostile to inquiry for an event co-sponsored by a research center the conference seemed to be. To be honest, I don't recall attending any panels on Victorian pornography or ancient Greek vases, and maybe if I had, my one-sided experience would have been mitigated somehow. What I do recall, however, is that over the next few days, I found myself absorbing one unrelenting, expertly media-trained, celebratory pan to commodified sex positivity after another, and feeling more and more depressed by the hour. The conference's best-known, most vocal attendants seemed to respond to all but the most ingratiating questions by invalidating them and then swiftly shaming the interlocutor. The porn stars stuck to their talking points and stayed on message. Liking sex was the preferred euphemism for making or consuming porn. Conversely, harboring even the slightest ambivalence about it meant that you categorically hated sex and were out to ruin it for everyone else.
Was your last conference like that you've been to?
Well, I think that was the only conference ever like that. I think that they never did that again. It was really weird.
But I have no more than a question, I think it's a comment. Lately, I was fighting not to see it because the name of the movie was The Mona Lisa Smile. I don't know if any of you have seen it. And it was with Julia Roberts, so I thought, I am not going to see this movie because it must be very stupid. But I did. And last night I saw it, and I was, that you need to see it. I was really surprised. The movie is set in 1953. Was he
thought? Oh yeah, I know about this movie, and it's about a teacher.
And you know, the problem is, me being Latin America, in those times, except for white times, I was in Lima, Peru, very happily living. I didn't know if women voted, not voted. I just knew that I had to get married fast, as soon as I got out of school. Not college, school. So we got married at 20, 19, 21. That and everybody else did. No, what was happening in the United States had no relevance to me. But then I had to move to the States immediately at that same age. Married and came to Chicago. I was dumped into this process.
Well, you're talking about, but that movie is like...
And I got a job in a company where a very rich family, the mother of my boss who was young, had been in college, and my friend Janet had been in college, and my friend Michael had been in college. The only one that didn't go to college was me. They all did. But they were all married.
To find husbands.
They were all married. They all lived in Lake Forest, Illinois. They all had two children, and some of them were extremely unhappy. Others, more or less, they all drank two gin and tonics at 5 p.m. to be able to face dinner and homework for the kids. And it was, you know, and I looked at that life and I thought, and all of them went through, what do you call the hospitals where they go for alcoholism? Oh, they all went to rehab. My friends, I did. So, you know, this movie shows you what it is.
That movie, I think, talks about, it's sort of the Betty Friedan era, and it's about how in the 1950s they took the...
But my comment to you was, Karina, all of the girls at Wesley knew that they were going to be there and got married before they graduated from school.
Yeah, that was the thing that Betty Friedan talked about in that Feminist Mystique, that it went backwards from the 30s and 40s to the 50s. They started to push, and especially at the women's colleges, they started to push that, they changed they changed the curriculum, and they started to make it...
So it was our fault then?
No, they started to really make it a thing that after the war, it was a very kind of concerted thing.
Do you think that the movies have moved forward since the 20s and 30s? Because I'm thinking of like Miss Girl Friday and the strong female characters. Like, where do you think we are in that trajectory?
Yeah, I think that it's gone like in a lot of ways backwards. You know, although now we're in a kind of a good moment again, but until really recently, it was going in a completely different direction. And I think that, like, a lot of it has to do with the fact that, we were joking about it, it's Reagan's fault in the 80s, but it's a lot of it, I think, is media consolidation and studios and the idea of, like, all stories as product and how they're sort of produced in such a pipeline way, and were more than until recently where things kind of have opened up. Whereas in the 20s, you had a much more, like, random, you know, just people telling stories. It was a little bit less linear.
Were there more female directors and producers at the time?
Until the 30s, there were a lot. Yeah, in the teens, there were more than there are now.
Yeah, not really that. And then what happened?
They got pushed out. The studios, once it became corporate, this has happened though. In like computer programmers are predominantly female too. I mean, the person who invented programming was Ada Lovelace. So, like, it just, once the money comes in and the corporations kind of consolidate the power, the women are pushed out. Carrie?
So what are you seeing in the media right now that you're most, I suppose, inspired by on behalf of Europe in this
Well, I think inspired by like the fact that there are more outlets now for that allow for like different expressions and different stories. So it's not as monolithic as it was when I was in my 20s and 30s. But frightened, I don't know. I think that like in the last year or so. You know, I feel like when I started writing this book, I was like, oh, I'm insane. Like, you know, you just think you're crazy for like noticing these things, and you think you're the only person noticing these things. And in some ways it's validating that like now everybody's talking about these things, but it's also like horrifying that it's so out in the open. And it's kind of unbelievable.
People are fighting for, I mean, what is this, you know, that.
Yeah.
So here's a question. This idea of girl is not real.
Uh-huh.
A lot of these personas are so over the top ridiculous, then why is it so pervasive in movies? Why is this girl?
Well, I think that that's the whole thing, is that it's an idea of what this construction, you know, that was sort of, and it's kind of a capitalist creation, and it's very much tied to like, selling stuff and like women's roles as like upper middle class, you know, married women's roles as like consumers and displayers of status, and the people who are responsible for buying things.
You make a great about women as an extension of accessories for men. That's,
you know, last really thing I was just like, feminism always comes back during depressions and recessions, and it always goes away when the stock market's booming.
Except for right now.
But you know, everything else is bad, so maybe that's. We can't, now doesn't count because it's too late.
Can you elaborate on
how
the economics of it?
Yeah, I think that like, I mean, it happened in the 30s, it happened in the 90s, like, happened in the 70s.
50s.
The 50s.
But why is that?
Because when there's money, and especially like when there's money on Wall Street, I think, like, you know, women don't participate in these economies directly. They almost only participate indirectly. Like, anywhere where there's, like, a lot of money and power, there aren't a lot of women. And usually they're just, don't have, you know, they don't have a lot of access to it, you know? So their participation in the economy is usually, like, through marriage.
But that's from such a curiosity to me, that this is still existing and we still have this problem. It's actually gotten worse, when in fact, because of women's economic status, especially in this country, rising so much, and women don't ostensibly need, you know, my mother couldn't buy a house, my father didn't.
Well, she couldn't even get a mortgage until 1973.
Well, that's what I mean, she couldn't buy a house.
Or a car loan.
So now that's changed 100%. Mm-hmm. Women are economically viable and can. And yet, why has it gotten worse, or at least, why is it not shifted?
Because it doesn't. Because the whole system isn't. I mean, it's not set up to support it. Like, it's when we start. You know, we go to school in equal numbers. We start out in the workplace in equal numbers. We're paid about the same amount in our early careers. And then we start to drop out with age, and it starts to do with like having kids and how that, you know. Most companies don't support that and put all of the onus on women and pay. Usually, like, men get a paternity bonus, but women start making less.
Right. I guess my question to you is, so having, what's interesting to me is that why is it the images continue to be the same even though the economics have changed?
Because who's making the images?
Men.
Right.
I'm curious, did you read the article in the Atlantic a couple weeks ago about how America went AY?
I think I did, but remind me what it was.
Well, he coined this phrase, the fantasy industrial complex, and started to talk about how there was a period in which, whatever side of the spectrum you were on politically, people started to decide that they could create their own reality.
Yep.
Right? And so, as much as we blame Reagan, which
I do. In what, where psychologically have the left, or whoever, you know, what the people you think are on the right side have been signed on to the fantasy that we can create whatever we want to create? And how, so like when you were saying, why are the images the same?
Mm-hmm.
To a certain degree, I feel like it's somewhere in there. It's that we, whether we believe we can have it all, whether we believe, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And where does responsibility lie in the
Well, one of the things I think is that, like, the structure, like, of the, you know, the corporate structure is like, what, it's like 100 years old, and it hasn't really changed that much. It, like, comes out of, like, the 19th century. It didn't exist. Corporations didn't even exist before, like, that long, you know. And so I think that we treat this stuff like it's just the way of the world or human nature, but it's not. It's culture, and it's fairly recent. We made it, it was made this way, and so this is how it works. So like, if you're expected to stay, you know, you're expected to stay at work, and there's no like social, like help for women, say with young children, you know, choices are forced, and I don't know if that's what you're saying, but the image I think remains the same because we still buy into the story. I think there's a disconnect between like, what actually happens in the stories that we see.
We can take one last question, okay. And then we, then you ask the questions when we do sightings.
Okay, okay.
So
you
can
go.
I just have a comment. I mean, it's a really interesting discussion, but I just want to point out, so I grew up in Bulgaria, which is a communist country, and right before the wall fell down, you know what movies showed up in the Bulgarian movie theater?
What?
It was Pretty Woman and Flash
Dance. Oh my God. That is like imperialist indoctrination.
Yeah.
Right there.
Are absolutely integral through the whole system.
Absolutely.
You have to believe it.
You have to believe it.
Yeah.
Or else it falls apart. It's completely reliant on these stories.
It's also, you know, it's also to underestimate the power of advertising in your country. It has a lot of propaganda that's there.
Mm-hmm.
For capitalism, you know,
right.
This fictitious world, so in a way that doesn't stop, you know?
Yeah.
Entertainment, that's modern propaganda, and you have to be careful with what images are portrayed.
Yeah, they're very powerful.
So, there are more questions, but...
You've been listening to the Skylight Books author reading series. Don't forget, you can listen to this and all of our other great podcasts at skylightbooks.com. Thanks again for stopping by, and we hope to see you soon.